Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hey, John, how you doing?
Hey, B, what's up?
Well, not much. I'm just fixing to have a nightcap here. How about you?
I am actually nightcapless right now. I don't even know if I have anything in my fridge.
That is a very sad thing to hear. Well, I guess we should note for anybody who actually is out there listening that this is our first attempt at a three-way call. So we're just waiting for Jay to show up here.
I'm here.
Whoa, when did you come in, Jay?
Crazy, huh?
That is pretty crazy.
I just snuck in the back door, as it were.
Yeah,
which sounds kind of gross when we call it a three-way, especially between three guys.
Yeah, I guess. You know, some people might find that gross. Facial metaphors just seem to be rampant, though, because I was feeling the same way, that we're somehow in a space together. And I didn't feel that way when it was just two people. So who knows? But
yeah.
Anyway, John, you are out there on the West Coast, am I correct?
Correct. I'm in Oakland.
In Oakland, okay. And Jay, of course, is in the Mountain Time Zone, and I am now and still remain in New Orleans. So we are actually spanning three time zones with this call, which I
find
remarkable.
It's kind of
I don't know if it's ever happened before.
Certainly not.
I don't know if I'm early or late is the problem. I'm kind of in between.
Yeah, you're in between. So perhaps it also should be noted that unlike previous guests that we've had kind of on the podcast before, John, you have never actually appeared in an episode of Rocks. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
So you're just kind of an old friend from the dorm back in our college days, and somebody who is familiar with Rocks as a show and familiar with us as individuals, but that's kind of where it ends. Actually, I should also note that I'm kind of a fan of your work as well, especially that first novel that you wrote and published, Summer Rain, set in Bloomington.
Thank you.
In the summer of, what, 92?
92, which is when Rocks started, right?
Yeah, sure. Kind of special year for me. So reading your account of that, which, of course, you had a completely different 1992 than I did. But still, Christy and I both found it fascinating.
And I think we actually briefly worked at the same place in 1992, the not-to-be-named call center.
Not the, if it was 92, then it must have been Dial America.
Oh, okay. I didn't know if you were.
I think we can say that. They closed in Bloomington, by the way. I don't know if you're familiar.
Oh,
but,
wow.
There was a little write-up about that in the paper, which somebody sent to me. And, they enabled, really, Dial America and their the part-time telemarketing job that I had there kind of enabled Rocks even to happen in the first place, because it was a part-time job where, unlike a lot of part-time jobs in Bloomington, I actually could earn a decent wage and work a relatively short work week and still have time left over for creative pursuits on the side.
Or in your case, sorry, I was going to say in your case at work, because as I recall, you arranged the order of clips for the show while you were doing telemarketing.
Well, it's true. I did a lot of. I was able to do a lot of creative work while I was talking on the phones, because it's fairly mindless. You know, just reading a script and so forth.
Yeah.
But that's all, of course, ancient history. And I'm wondering what's going on with you guys these days.
What's
John,
going on up there, John?
Yeah, in particular, John. I haven't really talked to you probably since 1992. Or earlier. So what's up? You just bought a home in Oakland, is that correct?
Yeah, we just we bought a place in May. We bought a townhouse, my wife Sarah and I, and we are kind of settled in, or at least, you know, all the furniture is in here. I think it'll take another 10 years to really get up and running on everything. But Yeah, I've been in the Bay Area for almost a year now, and I moved all over. I left Bloomington in 95, and in order, I lived in Seattle, New York, Denver, L.A., and now here.
Wow.
Well, so basically all the big cities in America, except Chicago.
Pretty much.
Yeah, except yeah. Chicago and Houston. Houston's pretty big, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Atlanta. You got some work to do, man.
Area. Yeah. Well, hopefully this is the last stop, at least for a little while, at least given the amount of work it took to buy the house and fill out all the paperwork and everything else. I'm hoping we stay put for a while.
Yeah. So you just bought a house during the housing crisis, it sounds like.
Yes, we timed it pretty much perfectly.
Cool.
And my impeccable timing was even more because we closed on this house on a Wednesday, and on that Sunday, I actually broke my arm. And it was my right arm, and I'm right-handed, so I had to sign my name 250 times with my broken arm.
Nice.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, Vicodin. So, yeah, but we moved here and lived in an apartment for a little while, and pretty much everybody said, you have to buy a house, you have to buy a house. And we've wanted to for years, but in New York, you can't really buy a house. And we didn't really settle down anywhere else, and you know, long enough to really go through the search and buy a place and everything else. But it worked out, and you know, we looked all around, looked in the East Bay, and found a place, and went through all of the, you know, recapitulating, you know, 10 years worth of bank receipts and everything else, and here we are.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I'm convinced, after 7 years of home ownership, I'm convinced that the only thing that sucks more than home ownership is renting. So,
yeah.
You know. It's got its ups and downs, and there are some downs. Not to pick the blush off the rose, so to speak, but it's still at the end of the day, barring natural disasters or unnatural disasters, you're still better off, I think, than renting. I'm discovering that now because we're fixing to sell this house that we've been living in and working on so much and move, but hopefully not too far away. So actually, we're making an offer on another house. We just signed the forms or signed the paper to make the offer, and that should be happening within, you know, next morning, tomorrow morning.
Wow.
And yeah, and then I'm taking this next week off of work to really bear down and get this house ready to put on the market, because the offer we're making is contingent upon the sale of this house, which
yeah.
I understand is done all the time, but of course it's complicated and first time I've ever done it. And all of this, of course, is because, as I believe you guys know, it's not all because of this, but largely motivated because our daughter has got a mild lead poisoning. And
yeah.
This last month or so has been just really quite hellacious for us in terms of that just, you know, dominating every waking moment, so to speak, trying to figure out where's the lead coming from, what does this mean for the future, you know, what have we done wrong, and so forth. And it's all quite complicated and I guess right now, to sum it up in just a few words, I'd say, you know, our hope is that this is just a mild thing, and that in the long term, there's really nothing that you can see, no ill effect later in life. But
right.
That's by no means a guarantee. So it just sucks, really. It not to put too fine a point on it, but the lead isn't the only thing that, you know, led us to want to sell the house and so forth. There's also just, you know, the other factors, and it just seemed like, you know, maybe this is a good time to kind of trade up a little bit and get into a nicer place.
Yeah, well, I think it's a pretty cool and exciting thing for you. I mean, I know from my experience with this place and with the previous place that we lived in next door, I think you mentioned in one of your blog posts how it's hard to sort of pull yourself away from it emotionally, because you do get sort of emotionally involved in this space that you created, and especially with you going through Katrina and rebuilding that house essentially, or at least rejuvenating it majorly,
right.
You know, it begins to become something of a kind of shaped in your own image, and tied up in your sense of identity, which that's the big thing, going back to what you're saying about renting, that that has been so different for me with owning a house versus renting. And, you know, we rented the house that we first owned for, I moved into it in 97 and bought it in 2000. So, you know, I kind of had the experience on, you know, both sides with the same house. And the thing that I remember was the most thrilling moment was realizing, and it had never really hit me like it did after we closed, that, you know, if I wanted to knock down a wall or repaint or, you know, do something to the place, I didn't have to ask anybody. And I did send you videos in one of the Rocks episodes of the night that I got a little bit drunk and had been planning on starting to renovate my bathroom, and just one night went in there with a huge claw hammer and made waste of it. And it just was sort of cathartic to be able to do that without worrying, you know, about, I mean, you know, I worried about certain consequences, but one of them wasn't what the landlord would think. But the flip side of that was, it was my problem the next morning when I realized that I actually had to do the work to get it back in shape. So.
Yeah. Often it's the morning after when those realizations come upon you.
It's interesting that metaphor seems to come up a lot, like during our search and, you know, kind of trying to justify buying a house, the whole, if I want to knock a wall down, very common bit of Americana or something. Now that we have this place, I can't really find a wall that I would want to knock down, but, you know, give it a year or two.
You won't have the experience that we did, which was after the floods of 2005. We tore down all the walls. I mean, and just discovered that there was a lot of termite damage underneath there, and so we literally rebuilt the entire lower floor of this house while we lived upstairs, which to me was an amazing thing. It could even be done, you know. But the entire time, you know, as much pain and effort as we put into it, the entire time I was doing that, I thought to myself, and I got myself through that by saying, you know, we're not just making ourselves a nice place to live here. We're also protecting our investment, because, you know, we're hung up on a big mortgage on this house.
Yeah.
And, you know, if someday we're probably going to want to sell it, and it's got to be in habitable condition. It's got to be in good condition in order to sell it. And so, of course, there, you know, we haven't sold it yet, but when I got the property assessment last year for property tax purposes, I was kind of astonished. We bought the house for $107,000. And they were assessing it at $170,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'd love to think the house is worth $170,000. But I really didn't think it was. But, you know, I went ahead and paid the taxes anyway. And now we're talking to a realtor whom I trust and have a lot of respect for. She's the woman who got us into this house, and she's just, pretty cool person. And she came and, you know, took a look at it and looked at the neighborhood and everything that goes into it, and said, you know, yeah, I think 170, 180, you might be able to get that. And
yeah.
That is, of course, after paying our monthly house note for 7 years. So we still owe, I think it's $88,000 on this house.
Mm-hmm.
But you could have, obviously, if we were to sell it for $180,000, that's the best case scenario. I don't even know what we'll list it at. We would have a bit of change, and it's certainly the only way that we're able to think about making the offer on the house that we're looking at now.
Yeah, right.
Is with that substantial windfall. So, I'm hoping that in a few months' time, we'll be living in a house with central air conditioning and central heating. That'd be pretty cool.
Building a campfire on the middle of the floor every night.
Yeah, well, in this house, we have two wall furnaces upstairs, and that's really it for in terms of any kind of permanent installation for heat. And granted, it's a very warm climate here, but it still does get freaking cold. I mean, it does freeze occasionally.
Yeah.
And, you need that heat. And honestly, as much as you would think central air is the key thing, I really think central heat is even more important.
Right. I have been wondering one question about all of this, given the dominant theme of your blog conversation lately, the lead poisoning and the lead content in the house. Typically with older houses, at least with our older house, there was sort of a don't ask, don't tell thing where, could legally say we don't know of any lead content here because we've never had it tested, but we don't know of any. You know that it exists. What do you do?
Well, in my case, when we make the sale, we'll sign that disclosure saying that we do know that there are lead hazards in the house. And yeah, I knew that when we had when we tested and so forth, that we were exposing ourselves to the fact that now we can't say we don't know.
Right.
And publicly, I've been very public about all of this, so obviously even more so than anybody else, I can't pretend I don't know that there's lead here.
Yeah.
Aside from any more,
you kind of have there, though, is, you've done a certain amount of remediation. You've painted over. If you say, well, there was lead in this house, obviously it's older than 5 years old. It's, back when they used lead in paint. But you've done this and this and that to fix it. I know when we bought this place, of course, the state of California is pretty insane. I have a whole box full of disclosures about, various earthquake stuff and all of this. And I know that the place I live in now was just built last year, but it was built inside of what used to be a warehouse. And we had to sign a disclosure saying we realized that could have been painted at some point in the past with lead paint. Although they kept the floor and part of the ceiling beams and stuff. So there's no way we could even be anywhere near lead paint. But, they still disclose it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of California being insane, and so forth. Lead is a huge issue in New Orleans. Different states have obviously different legal ramifications for this kind of thing. Different standards for how much of any particular chemical is allowed. Does anybody care to guess where the lead poisoning capital of the country would be?
Ooh, that would be a good question. Washington, D.C.
No. Yeah, and it's not in California. It's not in Montana. So
Baltimore.
Goes off the table. That's a good guess, too. But actually, Cleveland, I believe. Now, I'm not for sure. It may be that Ohio has a different standard. I heard from somebody that they've got more stringent standards in Ohio, of all places, than the rest of the country. But the amount of lead, we all carry some lead around in us just because it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere, and we grew up with it, a lot of us anyway. General feeling seems to be that the standard of how much lead constitutes poisoning has decreased over time. So, for example, by the standards before, I guess in the 80s or whatever, I think the standard was changed in 1990 or so. So back in the 80s, in other words, our girl would not have been considered poisoned. But then they lowered the level. And the thing is that nobody, as far as I can tell, has ever been able to detect a lower limit to this kind of thing. So, in other words, there's no amount of lead that seems to be safe. And so some people are saying that even the level that we have now nationally, which is like 10 micrograms per deciliter of blood, anyway, whatever arbitrary level that is, needs to be even lower than it is. And, you know, it's not something that you ever think about until you start thinking about it. And then, and I just would hope that you guys never have to think about this, but in our case, if we had just been a couple of micrograms higher, the city would have sent out a person to our house automatically to inspect things. But we didn't, and so that didn't happen. I hired the same guy, the guy who is actually in charge of the city's lead inspection program, to come out here when we were, you know, panic-stricken about just hearing about this. And he did some testing out here, but, you know, he wasn't really actually very thorough. And I wish he'd taken a more active role. He kind of said he'd test wherever we wanted him to test. But...
Yeah.
What do I know about it? I'm not an expert, and I was kind of shell-shocked at the time, and so was Christy. So the fact is that, you know, now we can say we've had a great amount of remediation done, and we think that there may be lead hazards in points A, B, and C. And whoever buys the house, you know, I hope if they have if they plan on having a young child live here, it'd be wise to address those things before they move in.
Sure. Yeah.
I really wanted to address these things before we put the house on the market. But, you know, the thing about lead paint is that it's best often just to leave it lie. Don't stir it up and create lead paint dust, which is just indistinguishable from regular dust. But it's so easy for it to get into a child's system. So we've pretty much decided that we're not going to do any more work on the house now with regards to that. And the best time to do it would be when there's nobody living here.
Right. Makes sense.
Is the lead a danger to adults also, or is this just because a kid is growing?
No, yeah, it's really mostly for kids. I mean, with the kind of environmental contamination that we're talking about, it certainly can cause severe problems in adults, but not usually from just this kind of environmental stuff. Usually it's like people who work with lead or have some reason of some kind of exposure. For example, with our bathtub, we discovered that this cloth bathtub, which was one of the reasons that actually – believe it or not, we bought this house because we love this clawfoot tub. You know, it's this huge, nice tub. So we found that had possibly some lead issues. But it doesn't really, you know, does the water in the tub really get into your system? So I've been trying to research that, and I found that one of the few documented medical things that I could find related to that was some guy who was making wine, homemade wine, in his bathtub. And wine is,
in
of course, very
bathtub?
Acidic. In his bathtub, yeah, in a cloth bathtub. You know, so wine being very acidic, it leached the lead into the wine, and he had severe lead poisoning. So it does affect adults in that regard. And in fact, some people think that it had to do with the decline of the Roman Empire and so forth. Well, I guess that's not necessarily lead poisoning. But anyway, it's been known for a long time that, like, plumbers and so forth, in fact, it's called plumism, I think, the lead poisoning madness. From plumbers working with lead-based pipes who would get it into their system and kind of eventually go crazy. And, you know, I've heard those things for years, but I never really thought that I would have to think about it myself. I guess in retrospect, I just didn't realize when we had this work done on the house, I kind of thought, you know, hey, we've got it taken care of. But I wasn't nearly as critical, I think, as I should have been of the workers who were doing the work and so forth. I mean, there were certain things that didn't smell quite right. The work was done by Acorn. The remediation on our house was done by Acorn, the organization, you know, which is fairly famous, especially after Obama's election, because it's been kind of targeted as a controversial aspect of his election. Because they endorsed him and got a bit of controversy surrounding some of their practices of registering people for, to vote and so forth. Well, anyway, and they basically do organizing, community organizing in poor communities across the country. And lead issues are really associated with poverty to a high degree because they tend to be an older places, in especially in inner cities and so forth, but which in the United States is, you know, where poor people live, not in the rest of the world necessarily, but certainly here. Anyway, they kind of did a sloppy job. And in retrospect, it seems to have been one of these things that's kind of driven by a grant. And they had this grant money flowing through, and, you know, they were trying to, I guess, execute on that grant, but they didn't necessarily, you know, have all the things in place to follow the procedures that they're supposed to. And so what it boils down to, I guess, is that they missed a spot, or missed several spots. And as it turns out, speaking of Acorn, my our administrative assistant in my where I work is at the university. Turns out her kind of daughter-in-law is like an outspoken critic of Acorn, who has been getting a lot of love from the right-wing media for speaking out against Acorn.
Well,
that's kind of bizarre. Yeah.
Isn't
Acorn based out of Louisiana? Is that?
No, actually, I think Acorn's based out of your area, John, if I'm remembering correctly.
I know they have a presence here. The area I live in, I'm in West Oakland, and kind of this area is pretty poverty-stricken, kind of dicey area. But I know there's some housing projects nearby that Acorn is somehow involved with. I don't know exactly what the
reason
was.
I thought that Acorn is either out of the Bay Area or Seattle or something, but I'm really not sure exactly. But I definitely have for some reason a West Coast vibe to them. But they're across the country. It's Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. That's what Acorn stands for. And in theory, I like them a lot, but in practice, I've just heard a lot of bad things, especially around here, about their lead remediation program. They had a bunch of volunteers working on our house, you know, church kids who were volunteering, you know, and I wasn't really able to be here during the day because I had to go to work. So I wasn't, you know, closely supervising what they were doing on our house. I was just grateful that we were having the work done. But I know somebody else in the neighborhood who, at the same time, was, you know, having them work on her house. And these church kids showed up at her house, and she ascertained that they did not have proper equipment, proper protection for these church kids, and that they did not even know that the scraping and so forth that they're doing was on lead-based paint. They didn't have any idea.
Well,
so, they're exposing these volunteers to risk. Now, granted, they're not, you know, infants, because it's under the age of six that you really just metabolize this stuff so easily. But still, it seems kind of irresponsible. And like I said, they kind of missed some spots here, so it's not good.
Crazy. Well, at least maybe you'll be able to walk away from the problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's hoping. The main thing that I think people don't understand about lead poisoning when I talk to them is that our daughter is, you know, completely asymptomatic. She's seems to, you know, function cognitively just as you would expect. Well, she's a year and a half old, so a child at that age. But they say it takes, you know, you don't really don't see symptoms at this, certainly for mild lead poisoning, you don't see symptoms until they're 6 or 7 years old or even later in life. And as I said, you know, they've correlated this kind of thing with loss, you know, lower IQ scores and lower academic performance and all kinds of things. Actually, incarceration rates even are tied to lead poisoning. So it could explain a lot about kind of what seems like the kind of dysfunctionality of New Orleans, but or a lot of cities. But at that remove of many years, it's kind of hard to, I think, you know, prove causation. Right, the correlation may be there, but it's also correlated highly with poverty. And I understand that they, you know, control statistically for those things. I'm just holding out hope that we're never able to see anything, but that doesn't mean that something isn't happening. They say that lead gets in there and it kind of introduces a disorganizing principle into the developing brain, and that even very, very small amounts, I mean, we're talking just so minuscule, you know, atomic amounts of lead can have this effect on the developing brain. And you never know. You know, whatever, however brilliant a child may turn out to be later in life, you can always just say, well, you know, they would have been even more brilliant if it hadn't been for that lead. The lead is holding them back. You know, and that's the kind of thing that I think is going to bedevil us for the rest of our lives.
Well, I if I can interject one word of perhaps hopefully positive encouragement, it would be that, you know, you've done what you can and you've controlled what you can control. You're taking the next step toward further removing yourself from this hazard. And beyond that, there are going to be those and of course, I know that this is easy for me to say from the outside, but, you know, it's something that I always try to remind myself with Julian as well, in general, is that there are going to be things that are going to, that I can't control, can't stop, can't step in the way and, you know, save him from, you know, whether it's falling down the steps for the gazillionth time, it seems, or, you know, any number of hazards that, you know, we try to do our best around this house, and think any parent does. But it has seemed lately like this is pretty much the only thing that I'm hearing from you on your blog. And you're not usually someone on a single track. And so it sounds like it has really kind of gotten to you in a way that a lot of things don't. And I would just encourage a little bit of just trusting the universe, as it were, because it sounds like it's a very painful issue for you when ultimately, you know, when you say, well, she might have been even more brilliant if she hadn't had lead poisoning. Well, who cares? As long as she's, hopefully a happy, functional person throughout life. You know, I mean, one of the things that I remember worrying, myself a lot about, well, what would happen if Julian is born with Down syndrome or something like that? But actually, I've gotten to be friends with a woman who has a 20-something-year-old son who I believe has Down syndrome. And she seems like one of the most happy parents that I know, because, you just learn to live with it, and there's still a wonderful human being there that that is lovable, and that you can, so what about those issues? So all that to say that I hope that you can find some peace in the fact that you're doing what you can.
Well, one of the upsides, I guess, is the lighter side of lead poisoning, if you will, is that I've had a chance to connect with a number of people, friends from back in the college days and other people that I've met along the way who have kids, that are dealing with different things like autism or cancer, kids who are literally fighting for their lives right now. Wow, sounds like somebody's mixing a drink.
Yeah, that'd be me.
Congratulations. Well, anyway,
yeah.
I mean, that certainly does put things in perspective. And, I would love to think 10 years down the road, boy, we sure did overreact on that lead poisoning thing. Hopefully that's exactly what we'll think. But, Christy teaches a number of kids right now who are designated special education because of lead poisoning. And I guess what really scares me about it is that it's a matter of cognitive impairment. Now, there's all kinds of ways that people can be cognitively impaired, but this is a preventable one. It's the number one threat, they say, the number one environmental threat to America's children is lead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's preventable, and that's what everybody emphasizes. Once it actually gets into your body, it's kind of difficult to get out.
Right.
And that's the health. But, it certainly does dominate my thoughts these days, but I do remain hopeful that, we'll never really see anything that we can notice from it, because hopefully we've kind of caught it at a mild stage in time, and we're doing all these things, to address it. And so hopefully that'll be the case. But even if not, ironically, just hours before I found out that she had this elevated blood level, just hours before, I had written posted something to my blog on the occasion of her being 17 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And saying that I didn't buy into this whole baby genius industry. I certainly want her to be a genius. That'd be great, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I would love her just the same, even if she wasn't the sharpest tool in the drawer. So it almost felt like this was, you know, I felt like there's something kind of Jobian about it, you know, some kind of biblical Job thing going on, like God is testing me.
Right.
Although, you know, of course, I really don't believe that there's some kind of willful aspect of the universe. I think it's just a lot more random than that.
Yeah, me too.
I'm trying to think of some response to the Jobian thing, but...
This is not to be confused with Job from Arrested Development, I suppose.
You know, I can't get down with that TV show.
You need to watch it from the start.
Do I?
Yeah.
Because, you know,
yeah.
it's the tone of it that I don't like. And, you know, that David Cross guy?
Yeah.
I hate him.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody seems to think that I would like him, so it must be one of those cases of, you know, somebody who's too much like you.
Wait, which one is David Cross?
John, can you help me out here? Which one is David Cross?
I've only seen the show maybe once. I know David Cross just from his stand-up comedy, and seems like he was on some other things too, Comedy Central type things.
Mr. Show.
Gotcha.
Mr. Show, yeah.
Mr. Show.
With Bob Odenkirk, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I always just felt like that show was just a little too intellectual and a little too, cruel. Somehow cruel in the drama.
You know, it's funny because when my next-door neighbor, Brian, gave me the DVDs, he said that it was the funniest show on television, and the only reason they canceled it was because it was too intellectual for TV. And I thought, that seemed appealing to me. And sure enough, I find it, as I watch it more, I can't believe that it ended up on network TV. I could see it being on something like HBO, which, you know, allows itself to venture into more esoteric and adventurous programming than most of the networks do. But anyway, you know, I used to catch, you know, portions of episodes, or maybe every once in a while a whole episode on Fox because it was on Sunday nights, at least around here. And at the time when I would see it, I was obsessed with a different show that was on Fox, which is almost embarrassing to admit, but I have a kind of inexplicable fascination with sort of reality, you know, caught on tape type shows. And the show Maximum Exposure was one that I particularly appreciated because it tickled one very specific guilty pleasure that I have, which is stupid people doing stupid stuff intentionally. And
is that a porn series or something?
What's that?
Is that porn?
No. Maximum Exposure is
one of those cops type things, except like people flipping their cars or doing dumb stuff like that.
Well, I'm
exactly. Yeah. So
that.
It's like, you know, either somebody, you know, trying to flip his bicycle off of his garage roof and ending up, you know, impaling himself on the fence or whatnot.
Maximum Exposure.
Yeah. You know. So. Anyway, so I used to watch that show a lot. And it was actually the only show that I regularly watched. And so Arrested Development was on before that, and I would sometimes catch an episode, and I thought, this is so dumb. I just didn't get it. I didn't like the sense of humor. I thought it was sort of a combination of trying to be smarter than it was and sort of just campy and stupid. And, you know, it may be all of those things, but it's also very engaging when you watch it from the very beginning. It's a lot easier also, to, you know, one of the things that I actually have enjoyed about our TV situation at present. We don't have even network over-the-air TV, so we're all DVD at this point because we don't want to pay for, we can't afford to pay for cable or anything like that, and the TV's in the basement where we can't get anything with the rabbit ears. So, you know, the TV shows that we see, we only see on DVD, and I actually have grown to really appreciate shows like that that are, you know, episodic and linear episode to episode. And that one in particular seems like one that really is best watched back to back.
Well,
I kind of see
a
lot. Because we didn't have cable for a long time too, so we would watch. We're big kind of Netflix junkies, and we would just sit and watch an entire series in the course of a weekend, whatever it would be. And it seems like TV now is being written kind of more with that in mind. I mean, it used to be your standard sitcoms in the 70s would be completely encapsulated. You know, I'm thinking like MASH or Three's Company, where every joke had to start and it had to be set up before the first commercial, and then a certain arc would happen, and then it would close, and then Radar would do something stupid, and that would be the whole thing. And now it's like something that happens in the seventh episode refers to something that happened three seasons ago or at the beginning, and it seems like TV's kind of getting a little smarter in that aspect.
Yeah, yeah. I think TV is, you know, I 10 years ago I would have said that there was nothing that interested me on TV that I'd seen lately anyway. And, you know, there's stuff on there now that I think is at least comparable to a lot of the Hollywood films that are coming out in terms of quality and thoughtfulness and either humor or drama. So that's pretty good because, you know, it used to be considered for actors getting into television was sort of, you know, the kiss of death to your serious career.
Well, you guys are forcing me to come out and mention the fact, you know, I watched Firefly a while back. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it was a science fiction series that was on main network television that got canceled after like 8 episodes. And I thought, this is the greatest science fiction television series ever made. But, you know, certainly that's damning with faint praise because there's not much that's good in that whole line. But then somebody told me, you know, you got to watch Battlestar Galactica, the new the Battlestar Galactica. So we just finally finished that. And I also have to mention, at the same time, my science fiction book club, of which I've been a participant now for, I don't know, 8-9 years, they sat me down and said, you know, there's just no question. We all know, it's well known and it's well understood that the best science fiction series is Babylon 5. So I
Babylon
5. Yes. I hear your skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
We watched both of those, by the way. Babylon 5, watched it almost all the way through. Couldn't quite go all the way. And Battlestar Galactica just finished it, the whole series. And yeah, I've got to say, Babylon 5 sucks big time. I just kept, you know, I'd read a lot of reviews and so forth about it. I kept waiting for it to get better and so forth. And you know, it just different people have different aesthetics, and that just does not do it for me.
Mm-hmm.
But and Battlestar Galactica, although I have some issues with certain things, I've got to say, yeah, definitely the best science fiction television series ever made. A lot of resonances with, you know, our current political situation and kind of the ship of state of America and so forth, and the human condition and all that stuff. I'm not sure when you look at those big story arcs that are, I mean, like John, you were talking about, that are borne out now over television series, and a lot of people actually do say Babylon 5 was one of those series that really kind of broke the mold and got us to these larger arcs. But still, I'm not sure that the larger arcs necessarily in Battlestar Galactica are all that compelling. It's more the kind of, to me, the situations, the more immediate situations. You know, I couldn't make sense of some of the larger stuff, but the more immediate situations of politics and so forth, and different pressures that are kind of being brought to bear on these people out in, they're sailing along on their ships out in space. It really did kind of resonate with where America's at now.
But is it really better than the first Star Trek series?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I really don't. I'm not one of those people who reveres the early, Star Trek or what's the other one? Well, anyway.
The Next Generation.
Mork and Mindy.
Yeah, certainly not. Certainly not. In fact, I was trying to make the argument with somebody the other day. Star Trek and Star Wars, are they really science fiction? I really don't think Star Wars really is science fiction. It's really just fantasy. It's a fantasy that's set in space. But there's really nothing science fiction about it. There's nothing speculative about it. I think Star Trek really is science fiction in terms of, again, there's that speculative element that I think is at the core of science fiction. And I think that's alive in Star Trek. I just don't think it's really that great.
So is Mork and Mindy then, would that be considered science fiction?
You're asking the wrong guy. No, that's a sitcom.
Well, but, I mean, he was a space alien.
Yeah, maybe it was. I'd have to review.
Okay.
Maybe they're going to make a movie out of that next.
Because I can hear the ice clinking in your glass and so forth there, Jay, I've got to assume that you are actually enjoying a nightcap as per specification. What do you have?
Yeah.
Diet Coke and bourbon?
You guessed me right. Trying to be predictable in at least one thing in life.
And yet, poor John doesn't even have an alcoholic beverage in his hand.
No, I don't.
Really? How did this happen?
Isn't that sad?
I'm actually not that heavy of a drinker, so I don't really keep that much in the house.
Oh, well, there you go.
If anything. And plus, I think since I moved, I think we jettisoned pretty much, well, we didn't throw it out, but I don't think anything made the move as far as alcohol goes.
Are you one of these people that tries to be healthy?
Actually,
in California. What can you do?
Yeah, I've actually kind of turned, just because I think since about, I think around the time I hit 35, I think the wheels just kind of started falling off, and I decided I needed to not eat at McDonald's three times a day. But
John, one of the things that you may be entertained to know is that out here in Montana, there is a certain xenophobia toward Californians. You know, that people here around Missoula in particular, because it's a sort of a favorite second home spot for people from out of state, and by and large, a lot of Californians. People speak of Californians as a pejorative, in reference to these outsiders who come in and buy up the place and bring in their big city notions and don't, blah, 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 fall into the culture that kind of thing. I mean, I hope you hear the sort of skepticism I have for that kind of attitude. But nonetheless, the interesting thing is that it seems to be that Californian is really a blanket term for any of these people who come in from the East Coast or the West Coast or, you know, some other far distant part of the country.
I've experienced that when I lived in Seattle for 4 years, and and in the state of Washington in general, we kind of had the same deal going on. I think there it was a little more. I mean, Microsoft was kind of up and booming then, and a lot of people were moving to Washington. You know, people in tech.
Oh, right.
People, you know, kind of getting into that. To the point that Washington Mutual used to have some commercials about, was it J.P. Morgan had some commercials with a stagecoach and so forth, and Washington Mutual kind of said had a commercial that had to do with California banks being highway robbers and stealing stuff from stagecoaches and so forth. And now they are Chase, so it doesn't matter.
Right.
But yeah, I'm familiar with that. And when I lived in Denver for a year too, and there, to a lesser degree, there was some of that too.
Yeah.
That Californian was kind of a bad word, and I guess I am officially one now. But I think within California, I mean, I live in Oakland, and, you know, Berkeley is just up the road. So I guess if I wanted to make fun of some vegan wheat germ eating type person, I could, you know, call that out. But so there are different degrees of California within California.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It was actually, I was at a town hall meeting held by our single state representative. You know, you guys have like 85 out there in California, and we have one. And he, not only in his speech did he talk about how it's his assertion that California has at least, I think he said, at least 8 more representatives than they should because illegal aliens are counted among the population. He cited that. Who knows if it's true? And then the other thing that he did was he was introducing his staff, and he outed one of them as having been, you know, born and raised in Montana, but then went to Berkeley, and everybody booed and hissed.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, it's kind of ridiculous, you know. I mean, I think that a lot of the resentment honestly comes from the fact that a lot of people can come from a place like San Francisco where, you know, in order to own a home, especially if you bought sort of, you know, 10 years ago or whatever before the boom in some of the areas out there, you know, you could sell, you know, your place with, you know, only half of it paid off, and come out here and buy a mansion with cash and not really have to necessarily work much anymore and that kind of thing. And I think that just a few folks like that kind of stir resentment in an economy like we have in Missoula, where you've got people with master's degrees working for 10, 12 bucks an hour.
Yeah. Yeah, the economic disparity is interesting. I know when we were looking at houses here, talking to people back in Indiana about, you know, my family and so forth, about the prices was kind of lunacy.
yeah, I'm sure.
And vice versa. I mean, you know, my sister bought a house a few years ago for $70,000 or something like that on 5 acres of land.
Wow.
In like rural northern Indiana, whereas $70,000 would buy you a nice car here. But other than that, so
not much. Yeah. $70,000 might be your down payment on the cheapest place you can find.
Yeah. Although right now things are a little different, but yeah. And
yeah, you know, Missoula was not really hit by much of a. You know, we had basically a pause in our real estate market, but not a real downturn to speak of. And it sounds like Bart was saying recently, I think in his blog, that New Orleans never really had, or, you know, not during the actual nationwide downturn, because it was having a recession recovery or a hurricane recovery that buffered against that. Did I get that right, Bart?
Yeah, that's right.
What about Oakland?
The East Bay was hit pretty hard, I think. I know our experience from looking at houses is we did see a lot of foreclosures. And I think when you have a house that's, you know, $500,000 or something like that, a lot more of your equity is going to be tied up in your house, and you're going to be, you know, a mortgage payment or two away from just being completely in arrears. So,
yeah.
There were a lot of people that bugged out. There was a lot of stuff really thrown off. And also a lot of people were, you know, pardon the pun, but underwater on their mortgages, especially a lot of people I work with and so forth that, you know, really have a lot tied up in how much their house is going to be worth when they retire. And all that kind of thing. I mean, it was definitely hit. And I work in Silicon Valley, which job-wise was hit pretty hard. Unemployment rates are pretty high and so forth. But that seems to be picking up now. And I think the other thing, too, is whenever a large part of Silicon Valley goes unemployed, 4 years later, you have a bunch of really incredible companies come out of it. So, I mean, I think everything that's come out in the last few years basically happened when everything tanked here in 2001.
Right.
So all of these companies like, you know, YouTube and MySpace and Facebook and everything else, you know, we're all from engineers sitting at home unemployed. So, which is kind of my hope in the long run that
that you get laid off and have your $1 million idea.
Yeah, or
while you're sitting around in your bathrobe.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let me know when that happens and I'll buy in.
Yeah. I don't see it happening anytime in the near future. I don't have much free time on my hands these days, but
yeah.
Except in my car listening to this podcast.
Right, yeah, exactly. I mean, this podcast should be like a staple of commuters everywhere.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if it weren't for podcasts, I would have gone completely insane not too long ago. My commute is roughly an hour each way every day, and I've been doing this since last October, so... yeah, I've already burned through a Audible.com membership of books on, not tape, books on MP3. And now I'm dipping heavy into all the podcasts to keep sane.
So what, you got a like a iPod that you plug into your car stereo or what?
Yeah, I've got the iPod, and I just, you know, load that up all the time. Got the iPhone also, which I actually work for a competitor over there, so maybe I shouldn't say that too much. But but I'm also a baseball fanatic, and Major League Baseball only has their stuff on the iPhone right now, so I had to get one for that.
Well, and you have to keep up with the competitors.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah. Competitive. Yeah, maybe I can write that off or something now.
Yeah.
We actually do competitive analysis of when things like that come out. We have a lab that just tears stuff apart. It's kind of interesting. Mostly just to see where where chips came from and how much companies are spending to actually make phones and equipment.
Wow. So, let me guess, it's a hell of a lot less than they charge.
It's funny because sometimes it's not. I mean, in the cell phone prices are very arbitrary, and sometimes the cost of a cell phone can be more than it's really worth with subsidies and everything else.
Mm.
And you see that too in some consumer electronics, like the place that I work is also big in LCD TVs.
Mm-hmm.
Not in my lab, but in another one. And LCD TV prices are very close to the bone as far as, you know, the cost of materials and building it and everything else versus
yeah.
how much they are down at the local Best Buy. And I think that, you know, all of this, Amazon and Best Buy and all of these other places have driven down the prices on some of that stuff, so the margins are very close. So it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I mean, I think all of us who have lived through this this era, going back into the early days of the internet and, you know, computer technology, just marvel at how cheap things have become. And yet, I think that, you know, so when I can, you know, when I really think about the fact that I'm carrying, you know, 4 gigabytes of flash memory around my neck,
yeah.
you know, when, you know, 10, 15 years ago, hanging that around my neck, I'd probably break my neck.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable how far and how low it's come. And yet, you know, I also, at the same time, have the sense sometimes that certain things are still, there's probably, well, there's obviously good money to be made in those things, even at the low prices that they've come to.
Yeah. Yeah, all of the memory and storage and stuff is interesting. I mean, I always tell a story about when I lived in Bloomington in 1993, I bought a 40 meg hard drive for my
mm-hmm.
computer, and at that time that was it was above middle of the road, and I think I spent something like $150 or $200. And just recently I bought a 4 terabyte drive for home, and I think I paid roughly double that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the same size.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's amazing. And I never would have thought in 1992 that you'd be carrying around a phone in your pocket or anything else.
Yeah.
Satellite radio or GPSs or anything else was just science fiction then.
Yeah. You know, one of the stranger convergences that has happened in my life here in Montana is I've become a very avid hunter. And I've gotten into hunting at a time when, you know, and a lot of it has been self-driven. So, you know, I'm not sort of adopting someone else's style, as it were, or, you know, learning from my dad, say. I'm just kind of learning from things I read and things I see and that kind of thing. And I think as a result, a lot of people who have grown up hunting find me a kind of strange hunter because I hunt with a lot of technology. And technology that, like you said, I don't think that people would have even imagined could be possible even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, my GPS completely changed the way that I can hunt because it used to be that every step along the way, you know, the first time, you know, when you're hunting for elk, you know, you're moving around a good bit. You're not just sitting in a tree or whatever. And you know, it's not much of an exaggeration to say that every step you stop and you look for an elk, and then before you move again, you also think about where am I and which direction is the truck.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I had two really scary experiences where I was certain I knew where I was, and then I came out in a completely different spot than I thought I was. One time just wasn't really sure I was going to be able to find my way out of where I was. So, but with the GPS, I don't even have to think about it. I mean, at my own peril, I suppose, if the, you know, if the satellites go down or if my batteries run out or whatever, but, you know, once it's time to start heading back, I just follow the breadcrumb trail, as it were. And I also hunt with these hearing aids, which I unfortunately got too late because I've sort of ruined my hearing with a pistol. But these hearing aids that amplify sound when I'm walking along. So, you know, I can hear things that that normally wouldn't be able to hear. But then if I fire my gun, it has the ability to shut off and become an earplug fast enough that I don't even, like, I hear the gun, but it doesn't sound loud. I actually hear the echo of it louder than the gunshot. Wish I'd gotten them 5 years ago instead of two.
Yeah, I've noticed my dad is an avid fisherman, and he's anti-technology except when it comes to fishing. And he has, like, more stuff to catch fish than, you know, the average army soldier has to fight wars. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Just the, you know, he has a whole database of, you know, lakes and where he has fished and what he caught and
mm-hmm.
what kind of weather conditions it was in. And if he goes to a lake, he can just say, oh, it's going to be hot at this time of day and I fish here and I know it's this deep and I know, you know, what time of year it is. And it just plugs in and he can, you know, instantly figure this stuff out. And it's just amazing. I mean, even...
Yeah.
10 years ago, I wouldn't have even thought that was possible.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. And yet, it seems like every one of these advantages comes up, and then you still have problems that will never be solved by technology.
Oh, right, yeah. For example, where are the fucking elk?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I keep searching Google Earth to see if I can, you know, at least, like, see a herd of elk, but so far I haven't. And, you know, even if I do, I'll get to see them where they were, you know, like a year and a half ago.
Right.
We need
well,
the technology that they have, like, in 24 where, you know, they can watch the live satellite feed, which, of course, you can't do.
And then hit the enhance button so the 320 by 200 picture of the planet Earth, you know, gets down to, you know, the light plate level.
Yeah. He's got a Mitsubishi cell phone in his hand. Yeah, exactly.
I think that's the bane of all graphic artists is the first time somebody comes up to you and says, well, just click enhance.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Been there many times.
Yeah.
But, hey, guys, that sounds like somewhere in there I felt like there was a good point to kind of wind it up because we have been talking for an hour and a quarter, I believe. And I think that it's probably time to say night-night.
Yeah.
That's my instinct. It's been a fascinating conversation. Touched on many topics, and I don't think that there's anything we could really say to emphasize all these different things, except to wonder about, you know, what are the elk looking at to keep one step ahead of you?
Right. Yeah. I don't know. Probably nature instead of a little LCD screen.
They're looking at elk pornography.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
All right, well, anyway, it's been fun talking to you guys, and this is, I guess, a successful conclusion to our experiment on what it might be like to have a three-way conversation.
Exactly.
Glad
yes, good
part of
good
it.
Talking with you, John.
Yeah, good to talk to you guys.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'll catch you on the flip side.
Sounds good. All right, later on.
Okay, bye.
Bye.